And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us on the Thursday already edition of It's Your Turn. These four-day work weeks, you could get used to these, couldn't you? Yeah, Thursday already, and the weekend looms ahead. Of course, a short week with Memorial Day on Monday. We have a good program lined up for you today. It is an Ask the Lawyer Day, first off. We'll tell you about our guest in a moment here. Later on the program today, an interesting guest. His name is Jason Gay. He is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. If you're not a regular reader of the Wall Street Journal, you may not realize that they cover sports. They do. And Jason Gay is a very, very funny guy, a very droll sense of humor, in addition to being quite the sports guy. He's written about using lessons from sport in life. And this is not some pie in the sky, you know, advice book like Dr. Phil or something like that. It's poignant at times, but it's extremely funny, very, very funny. I'm looking forward to chatting with him. He's in New York. He lives in Brooklyn. But we'll be talking with him by telephone later on the program today. First off, however, it is an Ask the Lawyer Day. Local attorney Will White is with us. He's a senior associate attorney at Dillon, McCandless, King, Coulter, and Graham here in Butler County. Will White, good to see you again. Nice to have you back with us.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Ask the Lawyer is a regular feature here on It's Your Turn. We do it periodically throughout the year in cooperation with the Butler County Bar Association and the executive director of the Bar Association, Janice Hackett. So we always like to thank her and the Bar Association. It's been a good joint effort that we've done for quite a few years now. I do want to mention, before we go any further, that any opinions that might be expressed on the program today are those of our guest, Will White, and me, and they're presented for informational and educational purposes only. For specific legal advice, as always, listeners are advised to consult their own attorney. It's good business practice. We have talked before, Will. I know that you have focused a lot in your career on oil and gas law. That seems to be not quite as hot a topic as it was a few years ago when we last talked. Mainly, I think, because the price of gas has been depressed, and as a result, there's not as much drilling going on around these parts as there were as it was just a few years ago.
That's absolutely correct, Dave. It's certainly not what it was, I think, 2 years ago when I was here last, and it's certainly not what it was 5 years ago when I think I was here the first time. There's still a lot of activity. It's just it's moved from production to a lot of midstream work now. We see a lot of right-of-way work, a lot of quiet title actions, things such as that.
Seem to be a lot of pipelines being built as opposed to wells being drilled.
That's correct, and that's what we refer to. That's the midstream or the secondary work, and I think that's simply a case of, at this point, most of the producers simply, there's no market for the gas, so once they've got the well in place or the well pad in place and they hold the lease in production, so to speak, meaning they've got the ability to produce the oil and gas in paying quantities, they do what we call in the industry, they shut the well in or shut the pad in, meaning they're just not going to produce, and they hold it in a shut-in status and then decide, well, let's work on the secondary things, whether it's the pipelines or the secondary production facilities such as compressor stations, things like that. So there still is some activity, certainly from a legal perspective and from a landowner's perspective, but you're absolutely correct, 100% correct, that the drilling, the production is minimal at this point.
These well pads where there have already been wells drilled, but they're not They're not removing any gas. They can start those up again anytime they want to, right?
That's correct.
Specifically if the price of gas goes up.
That's the hope. That's the hope, I think, of just about everybody in the industry and, of course, the landowners here in this area, that these wells that are shut in, and it's really quite simple. It's think of nothing more than, you know, a faucet. It's simply turned off. You can turn it on at any time, and you turn it on, and the volume is there, and the oil is there, the gas is there. There's never been a question about the fact that the wells that have been drilled in Butler County and northwestern Pennsylvania in general are certainly capable of producing significant quantities. It's just, as you indicated, the market right now just doesn't justify the further flooding or the further production.
So this is interesting, and I'm not quite sure. I certainly don't claim to be any expert in this area. I don't know hardly anything. But once a well has been fracked, then you can shut off the valve, but there's pressure there. You could go back 2, 3, 5 years later, open up the valve, and there would be enough pressure that you wouldn't have to frack it again, I guess is what I'm saying.
No, that's absolutely correct. A well can be shut in. Typically, when a well is sleeping or at rest and has been shut in, it's rare that I think, obviously every producer might be a little different, but it's rare that these entities would leave them in place completely untouched for years. They might, but instead of producing maybe 6 months out of a year, they might produce 1 month out of the year.
Okay.
They're going to want to, and the best way to think of it is, I often tell people, these wells are very much akin to a water well. And many people, obviously in Butler County, still have water wells. It's the same type of thing. You know, the fact that you don't use water in your home, you may be, you know, maybe it's your summer home or your, you know, whatever, the fact that the water hasn't been used, it might be a year or two, you come back, you would still expect that water well is going to produce water. Mm-hmm. However, we're familiar with the old phrase, priming the pump. It's better every now and then to at least turn it on, run it, so that the product that's coming up is in fact what you want to be coming up through those pipes.
Well, this could be perhaps a little bit analogous to conventional oil wells. There are very few of them that remain around here. These are shallow wells, of course. But you know, it's not unusual to see a pumping jack still in place at a well, but they only turn it on, you know, once a week or once a month, for that matter.
That is the very definition of held in production or held by production. That you drive by any farm field in western Pennsylvania, and you may see a jack that's been sitting out there, an iron horse that's been sitting out there for 75 years, and you might drive by that field every day of the week for 52 weeks in the year, and might see it operating once, maybe twice a year. But if in that 1 day or 2 days that it operates, it produces maybe 5 barrels of oil, and even at the deflated cost right now, if that oil, you know, on a yearly and annual basis makes the producer, you know, $500, $200, whatever it might be, and if the cost to produce those 5 barrels is only $10, mm-hmm. well, then by legal definition, that well is in fact capable of producing oil, in that case, in paying quantities, and as such, that lease is held in production, and they've basically bought themselves another year without having to surrender the lease to the landowner.
Now, you as an attorney working in oil and gas law, and I hearken back to what we talked about a few years ago when you were here with us, are you working mainly with landowners as opposed to the gas companies, or both?
No, I think that hasn't changed too much. Our firm has, as you know, has deep roots in Butler County, specifically in the real estate aspect of Butler County, Jim Coulter and others. And for that reason, when I was brought in to start doing the oil and gas, and as you indicated, I have a history of doing it long before I joined Dillon & Candless, but the majority of the clients I was initially seeing were homeowners, property owners, those types of things, who had been approached with a possible lease. From that, we ballooned, but on a very rare occasion do we represent the corporate entity, the drilling entity. Mm-hmm. I won't say it's never happened. I have done a few projects for XTO, or maybe on occasion some smaller, more private entities, local drillers, and those are typically the shallow wells. I know we do some work with Snyder Brothers and things like that, but my work predominantly is for the property owner, the landowner.
Are people still being approached by landmen? Landmen, it sounds like I remember when I first heard that term, it sounds like something from, you know, a Clint Eastwood motion picture, you know, Unforgiven or something like that. That's actually the official term that's used for representatives of the companies who come around with lease offers for property owners. They're called landmen. Are land men still going around here in western Pennsylvania trying to lock up leases from property owners that may not even bear any fruit until several years down the road, or has that died off too?
It's certainly diminished, but absolutely there are landmen, and again, you use the analogy of Eastwood or The Unforgiven. I've always thought of more of maybe materializing from a spaceship, or, you know, that they just show up on your porch. Mm-hmm. But yes, there are landmen still working Butler County, still working Western Pennsylvania. The purpose for the landman's appearance at your front door might be a little different these days. Again, from 2008 through 2015. The almost certain reason that landman shows up at your door was because they want to lease your property, get you an oil and gas lease. Nowadays, if a landman's at your door, I suspect the odds are that they probably want to put a right-of-way across your property.
Wow.
The midstream, as we were talking about, putting pipelines in, those types of things, whether it's water lines, transmission lines, gathering lines, different types of gas lines that we might see. But yes, there is still the occasional, I don't see them nearly in the volume that I did before, but there's still the occasional landman who's out there trying to do what we call the fill-in work, where they might have a production unit that they want to get up and running, and they being the engineers or the people, the architects who are putting it together, architect just being, you know, the term I use, might notice that, well, we're missing a five-acre plot over here, and here's a three-acre plot over here, and they're usually smaller lots, because if they were bigger than maybe 20 acres, they would have gotten them the first time through.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, these landmen are sometimes retained to go out and do what we call the fill-in work. They're trying to pick those smaller properties that are the holes in the production unit. Problem is, these landmen aren't offering what they used to.
Yeah. By the way, landmen, it's not a derogatory term. If you're not familiar with it, it may sound the way it is not. But these individuals obviously have the company interest at heart if they approach a landowner with a lease offer, and in many cases, most cases, I dare say, the landowner wouldn't have a whole lot of experience with this, whereas the company representative would, you know, that's what he does all the time. So that's why for most individuals, when they're approached, it's a good idea to think about consulting with an attorney, right?
I'm jaded in my opinion, but that's absolutely correct. I often say that the landman is akin to a salesman, a car salesman, that type of thing. And again, not knocking car salesmen, but their job is to sell, sell their product, to sell themselves. They're door to door, and if they weren't any good at selling, they probably wouldn't be doing that for a living. The other thing that the owner needs to remember, that the homeowner, the landowner needs to remember, is very oftentimes these landmen are not employees of the company that they represent.
Uh-huh.
More often than not, they work for a company that's been retained by the gas and oil company. And that can be important, because that usually means they're being paid some kind of not only a flat rate, but usually they're getting some kind of a bonus or some kind of a percentage if they in fact do get positive results. For that reason, sometimes you can have landmen who can be a little bit more high pressured than what you'd expect, because their job is not only to sell but to get the result.
Well, the other reason why I'm just kind of reviewing information that we've talked about in the past, an attorney who's experienced in oil and gas law may be able to talk about some options that you might request to be written into the lease that you wouldn't even know about. I certainly wouldn't even know about. Who would know about it unless you'd been approached before, and this is brand new technology. Nobody was approached before. What about, I seem to recall when we chatted a few years ago, you told me that it was fairly common practice for these, at least some of these leases, to have an expiration date. They were for a certain time period. If that's the case, I'm thinking that some of these might be coming up for renewal these days. Maybe that's a reason that other landowners would be being approached nowadays.
Dave, your memory is spot on. That's absolutely correct, and that's something we would have talked about. We would have talked about there's primarily two types of leases. There's a delay rental lease, which is kind of the old-fashioned lease. We've traditionally seen that in Pennsylvania going back hundred years. That's where basically the entity would pay an annual payment. So they might pay $50 an acre annually, and they would keep paying that until they have a well in place. Then, of course, that would be replaced with royalties. The newer, more modern lease that we see, and we start seeing these predominantly around 2008 with this unconventional drilling, is what's known as a paid-up lease, and that's a payment up front, and it's a lump sum payment. It might be $2,000-$3,000 an acre. And what that does is it gives the company a primary term. It's kind of like an option, or I'd describe it as a window, and it's usually 5 years. So they've got a five-year window. They've more or less locked the property up for 5 years, and during that 5 years they can commence production, or they might just simply wait until it fits into their production schedule. But the point is the landowner can't lease it to anyone else for that five-year term, that primary term. Most leases then have a clause that allows for a renewal option to pay it again and get another 5 years. Mm-hmm. That's pretty common, pretty standard, and you are 100% correct. As the heyday in Butler County was typically 9, 10, 11 into 12, many of those leases that were not put into production, in other words, a well pad wasn't put into place, are now coming up for renewal on the five-year primary term is expiring. And the interesting thing now is a lot of these companies are faced with a dilemma. They have a lease that allows them to renew the primary term for another 5 years, but at a rate that's much higher than the current going rate.
Uh-huh.
So, yes, the landmen are coming to you because they're now coming to you saying, hey, look, your lease is set to expire in September of this year. We could take for another 5 years at $3,000 an acre. We're not going to do that because that's three times what the going rate is right mm-hmm. now. But we would be interested in maybe taking one more year, just buying a one-year extension, and we'll pay you maybe $200 an acre, that type of thing. So, yes, we are seeing those types of scenarios where landmen are showing up saying, your primary term is set to expire. We don't want to lose you. We do want to put this into production, but it's still another year or two down the road before it fits into our plans. Let's amend this, or let's do an addendum to change the length.
Again, absolutely nothing. We're not even intimating any illegalities here. It's just something that, for goodness sakes, if you're approached, you'd want to learn about your options. You'd want to learn about a few things. Our phone number is 283-2525 if you have any questions for Ask the Lawyer today. It could be on this area. It could be in other areas as well. But I would imagine that there are quite a few people who have not been approached already, maybe will be in the not-too-distant future, about renewing a lease or exploring the possibility of adding on a year or whatever. Can you... If you signed a lease, say, 5 years ago, can you change the terms whenever a company comes to talk about renewing the lease?
We're certainly going to try.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a very it's a common question, and it's a common issue that comes across my desk right now. That that landman comes and says, "Look, your primary term is about to expire. We'd like to do a one-year renewal." And I typically am saying to the property owner, you know, what's in it for you? Are they paying you, hopefully? I mean, some of these companies approach you and say, hey, we just don't want to do a one-year extension and hope that the landowner signs off and they don't even get paid anything. At the mm-hmm. very least, I'm telling, you know, my clients, well, let's get paid for that one-year option. And to the extent there's any major deficiencies in the lease, perhaps the first time they did it, they didn't have an attorney review it, or they made a significant, you know, oversight on something. Yeah, we're trying to, if we can improve it, we're certainly going to try.
And obviously, if landowners had a lease agreement that called for a percentage royalties of the gas that was extracted, and they're not extracting any gas, then there's no royalties coming in, right?
That's correct.
And there are a lot of people, I know farmers in particular, who kind of mortgaged their future on this. You know, are we going to stay on the farm or not? And, okay, well, here's, gas money coming in, maybe we can swing it. Maybe we can try to, and suddenly they're not getting any royalties anymore.
And that's absolutely true. I certainly have more than a handful of clients who have, you know, the multiple 100-acre farms who for a while they were generating literally tens of thousands of royalties monthly, and that's dwindled down to maybe it's hundreds of dollars a month.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem is, you're right, they may have been budgeting it. They may have anticipated those royalties playing out over years as opposed to year. But I think in this situation, most leases have what's called a delay rental, and it's just a question of how much was the delay rental. It's certainly not going to be equivalent to what a royalty would have been generated, but if your well has been shut in, you should be receiving an annual payment for the company having shut it in, but it's typically going to run something like $20 an acre, that type of thing.
Nothing what you would have been expecting a few years ago.
Nothing even close.
Phone number is 283-2525. If you have any questions, 283-2525. Have there been any changes in state law governing fracking drilling? Fracking is the layperson's term. It's hydraulic fracturing of the rock.
Hydrofracking is
But everybody knows fracking is what we're talking about. It's an unconventional gas well. sometimes a mile deep into the earth. In fact, most of them are a mile deep vertically, and then they can go out horizontally with the new drilling technology. That's why they can have so many wells from one well pad, one relatively small well pad, because once they get a mile down, they can go out horizontally. Have there been any significant changes in state law since the boom in the fracking industry, particularly here in western Pennsylvania, because we're one of the biggest places in the state?
Well, the easy one there, of course, that's almost the softball question, is, of course, Act 13 would be the response. That Act 13 was supposed to be the all-encompassing, we're going to address all the issues, all the finite issues that are out there with regard to oil and gas. And that would be my simple answer. Of course, as you're well aware, Act 13 was challenged on constitutional grounds by some municipalities and some governmental entities. And that challenge was successful, and they basically got the appellate courts to determine that Act 13 was unconstitutional. The problem from a practitioner's point of view is that when the appellate court rules that Act 13 is unconstitutional, what they didn't really say is the entire act unconstitutional or only those aspects of the act which were problematic? And again, there were only certain aspects of the act that dealt with the local municipality's ability to legislate, to regulate, and to zone.
Local municipalities wanted to say how far a well had to be from a church or a school, for example, just hypothetical. They didn't want the state determining what that setback was going to be.
Absolutely correct. They still wanted to be able to legislate that we have zoning and it's permitted in maybe a commercial, it's permitted in industrial, but not permitted in residential, not permitted in residential two, it's permitted in agricultural. It's just standard, that's what you would expect from local zoning, and that's, I think, in that regard, I think the appellate court was correct that ability to legislate one's own backyard and the uses should fall to your local municipality. That's what you've basically designated, and that's what you've voted your supervisor or commissioner for. But the problem, of course, is when the appellate court says that aspect of Act 13 is unconstitutional, that the state has usurped the local municipality's ability to kind of regulate its own backyard. What about all the other aspects of Act 13 dealing with things such as reporting requirements? Distribution of money, certainly for the the funds, and the big one for us was setbacks. Act 13 established a 500-foot setback and had certain parameters on where things can and cannot be placed. Most people, I think, would take the position right now that Act 13. We seem to be taking the position that Act 13 still exists, and only those aspects that the court specifically struck down or designated as being unconstitutional are in fact no longer valid. Mm-hmm. The remainder of the act, until the legislature says one thing or until the appellate courts say one thing, we're going to take a position that's still on the books and it's still to be followed. And that seems to be the case with the producers. I know most of the companies I deal with are still following those aspects of Act 13. So that would certainly be the easy answer, is yes, Act 13 addressed a lot of that.
Is that why there's this nebulous area about what's still in effect and what isn't? Is that what has led to some of these controversies? There's been some pretty high-profile ones in the news locally recently, and without reference to any specific ones. There's been more than one. There's one in the Middlesex area. The Butler Township had a significant controversy. I don't recall whether that actually went to court, but again, it was a controversy over where these well pads going to be allowed. How close were they going to be allowed to certain zones, whether it's a school or a medical facility or whatever? Is it because the state law is kind of in limbo that we've had so many of these controversies and lawsuits sprouting up?
I don't think it's a fact. I don't think it has to do with the state law being in limbo. As you well know, Pennsylvania has long been a natural resource producing state and has been a state that, or a commonwealth that encourages the exploration, extraction, and development of our natural resources. I mean, mm-hmm. We go back to coal. We certainly look to steel and ore and all the other things. And oil certainly has a long history in Pennsylvania, having started in Pennsylvania up in Titusville, Drake's Well. Mm-hmm. I think it's not necessarily a case that we don't have the law in place. I think it's sometimes that there are, as is often the case with the law, there are laws that are open to different interpretations. And in this case, particularly when you're talking about something like West Middlesex, that's, you've got laws that deal with the statutory aspects, but then you've also got a state constitution. And in the Commonwealth's constitution, there's actually a provision in there that talks about the fact that the Commonwealth's natural resources belong to each and every one of us and are to be protected. And the state is challenged, and as the government is challenged to protect those natural resources for each of our benefits and to preserve those natural resources. So that's one aspect of the law that's created quite a few problems right now, is that you have the opponents of the exploration and extraction of natural gas coming in saying, hey, look, if you're going to permit this, you first need to examine, is that going to impact every single resident's constitutional right to have the natural resources protected? Because all of those resources, even they might be located on somebody's property, they're technically still a Commonwealth resource, and as it's a Commonwealth resource, I, as a citizen, have the right to have that, you know, protected and make sure it's being handled in a proper, efficient, that type of thing. And a lot of, you know, municipalities, when they're deciding to grant a permit, or if DEP is granting a permit, they aren't always conducting hearings as to whether or not it's for the public good. And is it constitutionally proper? And that's been a big issue. And that's actually kind of what led to the Middlesex issue. It wasn't really the issue of the permit. It was did the issuers consider the overall benefit to the public and the constitutional aspects of that?
I'd forgotten about Pennsylvania's history of protecting resources and the environment. Pennsylvania, as I recall from my reading, was in the vanguard of making sure that coal mine operations returned the land to, if not pristine condition, at least something close to that. And if you would fly over places, Kentucky, West Virginia, some of those other areas where they don't have the strict laws of Pennsylvania, it's almost mind-boggling to see how the land has been mangled by some stripping operations. In Pennsylvania, very strict laws about reclaiming the land, returning it to what it looked like before you stripped the coal out. Of course, this is where it gets kind of complicated, because, and it's where attorneys have to come into place. There's a lot of laws about, you may be a property owner, and you may have owned property for decades, but you might not own what's underneath that land, right?
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. In fact,
the first time you hear that, property owners, it's mind-boggling. What do you mean I don't own what's underneath it?
I could almost guarantee that if you're a property owner, you probably don't own the mineral rights, meaning the rights to the coal that's under your property. In fact, anyone who's done a deed of conveyance from, if I'm selling a piece of property, there's usually a paragraph that goes on every deed that's in bold saying this may not, probably does not convey the mineral rights. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, mineral rights are not oil and gas. There's case law in Pennsylvania that reaffirms that position. In the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, minerals do not include oil and gas. Oil and gas are separate from minerals. So if I were conveying a piece of property and I maybe put in my lease, well, I'm retaining the mineral rights. But if I don't specify oil and gas, then it's presumed that I have conveyed the oil and gas. So oil and gas has to be specifically identified.
What other minerals? Coal? Is that?
Coal is the primary.
That would be unless you had diamonds or copper or something like that.
Well, again, a lot of the areas I represent, particularly up in northwestern Butler County, limestone. Is a big one.
Yes.
We have limestone, we have quarries, we have gravel, so that's certainly an issue. That very common mistake that I have clients come in and say as well, I've got something here my grandfather signed 50 years ago or 100 years ago saying he was reserving the mineral rights to his property, and I have to say, well, yeah, back then he was keeping the coal, but that didn't mean the oil and gas.
Well, then what's that mean for the property owner? In other words, if I don't control the oil and gas that's underneath my property, underneath my home, does that mean that somebody can come in and extract that without my permission or without my approval?
It's an easy answer. Unfortunately, the answer is yes.
Wow.
Very easy answer. Now, what's interesting is if I'm that property owner, the big question is, if I don't own them, who does? And that's where we get into some very complex issues, because it's not so difficult if I can identify the party who owns the rights. But sometimes you have these reservations going back to, I have a deed actually on my property, on my desk right now, that's dated 1904, where an individual conveyed a part of their farm but retained the oil and gas rights for himself and his heirs. Well, that individual's no longer with us. And now we're trying to figure out, I represent the current owner of that property. And of course, that property is not as it was, because it was a 200-acre farm back now. My guy maybe has 40 acres, so it's been subdivided over the years. And we're trying to figure out who owns the oil and gas rights to those 40 acres. Well, I go back to the 1904 deed. I identify that individual. But now we've retained a genealogist, because we have to identify all the heirs. We have to actually check if each of those heirs knew they had those rights, and if so, did they, when they passed away, did they leave wills that said, my oil and gas interest in this 100 acres over in Butler County conveys to some? It can be quite a nightmare. It really can. The quiet title issues are very problematic in Pennsylvania. And in fact, there was a Senate bill introduced, I believe, last year. I want to say it was like 258. I always think, because I think of Jack Lambert, 58. 258 was a Senate bill that was introduced where Pennsylvania was going to try and close this loophole once and for all. And it was, you've probably heard of adverse possession, that if I'm on a piece of property for a period of time, 21 years in Pennsylvania, and my possession of that property is open, continuous, exclusive, notorious. In other words, I possess it against all comers and I hold it for 21 consecutive years, I can actually acquire title. I can claim that's now my property. Senate Bill 258 tried to apply the same principles with oil and gas, that but in reverse. If I own a piece of property and somebody else claims to have the oil and gas rights, but a period of time has passed, and they don't act on those oil and gas rights, or they don't reassert them, or they don't file something, that they can lose those rights and they would revert back to the property owner. I actually thought it was a great idea. I was a big supporter of it because I thought it would really solve a lot of these, you know, these problems where we have these absentee, you know, owners who've left them to heirs who are now 48 different heirs all spread all over, you know, through California.
Didn't pass.
But it didn't pass. It didn't, and to my knowledge, it didn't even make it out of committee. But it was reintroduced last year as well, and I, to my knowledge, it's still languishing.
Well, does the new technology of fracking, is that why that introduces a new wrinkle? I mean, if you're talking about coal, for example, and you don't own the mineral rights, I'm assuming that an underground mine could go under your property and extract coal. They couldn't come in and strip it, right? I mean, they couldn't do strip mining on your property.
Yeah, I believe they could.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Let's use the example of you own your property, and I used to be the owner, and when I sold it to you, I reserved the oil and gas rights. I now lease them to Joe's Gas Company, and Joe's Gas Company tells me they want to put a well on the property. Let's say they want to put it on the neighbor's property, so they don't really want to put it on your property. But to get to that well, they need to run what we call a PAR, a permanent access road, across your property to access the well site. Absolutely, under the current status of the law, Joe's Gas Company, based upon the fact that they have a lease with me, would be able to put an access road across your property to develop oil and gas rights that they've properly leased.
What about pipelines? You said that in today's climate of depressed natural gas prices, a lot of companies are concentrating more on, I think the term you used was midstream. They're building a lot of pipelines. Heck, we see it around here. You know, it's very common to be driving along a highway in our immediate area and see, you know, there's a pipeline going in. You can tell. There's heavy equipment. There's a new right-of-way and so on and so forth. Can property owners deny companies the right? You know, if they come in and say, well, we're building a pipeline here and looks like it's going to have to go across a piece of your property and we want you to sign off on it. Can a property owner say, get out of here. I'm not. I don't want your pipeline coming across my property. I'm not giving permission.
Well, I think the simple answer is yes. If first of all, you have to determine what type of line. And as you said, all you have to do is travel up and down 422, and you're going to see multiple lines crossing 422 that are in the process of being developed. And I can give you two different examples. One of those lines would be a gathering line. A gathering line is typically a line that's going to run from a well pad to either it's a centralized collection point or a processing facility, maybe a compression station, something like that. A gathering line is typically smaller in diameter, and it's really just hauling the gas from point A to point B. But there is another line that's crossing 422 that's in the process right now. That's what we would refer to as there's gathering lines. And then there's basically lines of conveyance. These are transmission lines. And these are, think of your Alaskan pipeline. These are much bigger in diameter, and they're typically conveying gas not from a well to a production point. They're typically conveying gas from a large facility maybe in northern Pennsylvania to Louisiana, that type of thing. They're interstate lines. They're larger in diameter. They have much more volume. And those types of lines oftentimes depending on the entity that's building them and the purpose, they may be regulated by either federal law. They could even fall under what's called FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. And if they fall under those types of parameters, they can take the property.
So it's like eminent domain or something analogous to that.
So again, Joe's Gas Company is just putting a well, wants to put a pipeline from its well to a point A to point B. Joe's Gas Company is not a PUC. They're not a public utility. Therefore, they can't take. Okay, the only way they can get across the property is if they have the right to the property. Perhaps it's in the lease that they have the right to run lines across the property in the lease. But absent something like that in the lease, no, they're in a position where they have to approach the landowner and negotiate the rights to put a pipeline across the property and pay for it. But if Joe's Gas Company is in fact a PUC regulated entity, the Joe's Gas Company also services homeowners and runs gas into their homes and that type of thing, then Joe's Gas Company is probably, since they're a PUC regulated public entity, would be able to take via a declaration of taking eminent domain the right to go across those properties.
Well, we've seen it a lot. I know it's crossed Route 308, West Sunbury Road. I've seen pipelines, Sunset Drive several places, Meridian Road, Evan City Road, Route 68, right out past the farm show grounds. It seems like there are pipelines going in everywhere. I can remember 15 or so years ago, there was a plan to put a pipeline across a portion of Butler County, and it raised an incredible controversy around here. And eventually, it went somewhere else. I think it was going to go through Moraine State Park, if I remember correctly. But now we have them, you know, seemingly just about everywhere.
I think, as you indicated, it's become an accepted. It's part of the parcel with the development of the oil and gas.
Can understand the concern of some people, though. Look at what happened down near Greensburg. I guess it was closer to Mount Pleasant, but Westmoreland County, last month when that pipeline blew up down there.
West Virginia had a large one about a year ago as well, right off of, I think it was right where 79 or whatever, one of the interstates, major interstates. It was right off to the side of it. So, yes, it's – but again, those would typically be transmission lines. And transmission lines, obviously, as I said, higher volume, larger diameter, and to the extent that there would be a rupture and some kind of ignition, you're going to know it.
283-2525, if you have any questions or comments, you can feel free to join us. That would be fine. I think we have a comment right here from one of the listeners. Hi, caller. This is Dave. Go right ahead. It's your turn.
I have a question for your guest, Dave.
Sure. He's listening.
The one who knows about the pipelines out around 422. I have a question. What is the apparatus along 422 out by the pilot gas station? Is that a pumping well or a transfer station?
I'm assuming you mean immediately west of the truck stop there. Is that correct?
Yes, on the same side.
I drive by that almost daily, and I myself have wondered. I initially thought that was going to be a compression station, but it doesn't appear to be a compression station. It looks very much like a well pad, but it's not like any well pad I've ever seen before. I'll be honest with you, I don't know the answer to that. And also, the way it's located, it's entirely too close both to the station and to the highway to be a well pad. I truly believe it's some kind of a relay station. I do know that that area, in fact, I represent a lot of the property owners out there that'd be up by McClyman's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know where she's talking about.
I know a lot of the property owners out there are clients of mine, and I know that area is heavily leased and is in production. I believe that's some type of a relay station, probably a compressor station, a smaller compressor station, but I don't believe it's a well pad itself, even though it does look like one.
Okay.
Sure.
Not answer my question. It leaves both of us in the dark.
Well, I can tell you, although it looks a lot like a well pad, it's not a well pad.
Okay.
All right.
I've just been wondering what it was. That's all.
Well, I can understand. I've wondered that too when I've passed some of these things.
I believe it's a compressor station, meaning that they would collect gas that's being produced in that area, in that region, and it's being pushed on elsewhere. It's kind of a... Think of it as a collection apparatus, and then they compress it into a single line and push it on from there.
Hey, thanks for the call, my friend.
Okay, thank you very much.
Sure. Bye-bye. 283-2525 is our number. Let's take another call, 283-2525. This is Dave.
Hello,
Dave. Yes, go right ahead. It's your turn with Attorney Will White.
Yes, concerning that their thing out there by the pilot. I had asked that question one time, and they told me that was a training well site.
That I would believe.
For training.
That I would certainly believe. That's why, again, it looks a lot like a well pad, but the location, it can't be. So to the extent they're using it for training purposes.
Yeah, that was my concern, too. Yeah, another thing on these pipelines, how can you identify, now, but only taking the word of them, that it is a transmission line, or is it just a gas line? Do they lease them and tell you what they are?
Well, oftentimes when, again, a client comes to me and says, the landman showed up on my doorstep, he wants to put a line through my property, it's usually the first question we ask the landman is, what's the purpose of the line? If, I would usually ask the client, do you have an oil and gas lease in place now, and is this for the benefit of the oil and gas lease? In other words, is this to run gas from the well pad, again, from point A to point B? If the landman tells us, no, this is a EQT or some other interstate entity wants to run this as a transmission line, I'm usually telling my client, okay, that's a whole different ball game, and we're going to be talking different prices, and we're going to be approaching this from different tact, because in my opinion, in that situation, you don't really need to let them do it. If you're subject to an oil and gas lease, it could be argued that you have to let them put the pipeline across your property, because you can't really lease them the right to extract oil and gas, but then deny them the ability to get it out of the ground or from once it's removed from the ground from point A to point B. But if this is going to be a transmission line, in my opinion, that's a whole different kettle of fish, and they better be opening up the checkbook.
Well, they would have to get municipal and state approval, wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
They've got to appear before certain governmental bodies. They just can't. Even if they have permission from the landowner, they're not able to just start digging.
Absolutely. And again, I guess to answer your question, caller, what we would specifically do in that situation when we're drafting the right-of-way agreement, and it's very common, is if we know they're just going to be gathering lines, meaning smaller diameter lines just for the transmission from point A to point B, we typically put in there that the right-of-way is being given for the purpose of transmission lines, for gathering lines only, and that this shall not be used for interstate gas transmission, shall not be used for utilities or other types of conveyance. So we usually put in limiting language so that they can only be used for the purpose we were told it would be used for.
Okay. Well, thank you. That kind of answers my question a little bit, because sometimes, you said they are car salesmen, and they do fib to you, get you the signs.
I'd like to think they're not fibbing to you, but I would agree, better safe than sorry.
Thanks for the call, my friend. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
283-2525. We all for a break. We'll do that. We have a little bit more time with Attorney Will White. 283-2525 is our number, 283-2525. One of our sponsors on the program today is the Society of St. Vincent de Paul here in Butler. It's planting time. I know for a lot of folks who've already got some of your plants in, a lot of folks do that over Memorial Day weekend. I can remember in my family, that was always a planting weekend, grandfather and father, and whether it was the tomatoes, the peppers, the beans, or whatever. We just like you to think about setting aside a couple of plants so that you can donate some fresh produce to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Cupboard. They've had a program for several years now where people have done this. They're not asking for heaven's sakes for all of your produce, heavens no, but a little bit of extra. A lot of folks have that. Sometimes they're looking for people who can use fresh produce. At the Society of St. Vincent de Paul Food Bank, they have to rely mostly on non-perishable items. It's the nature of a food bank. What a wonderful treat it is for families who rely on the food bank to be able to enjoy fresh produce, especially once it starts to come on a little bit later in the summer. So think about that. They will be starting. They have a collection process that makes it very, very easy here in Butler to donate items. You can take it to a central point. They'll be setting that up in a few weeks, and we'll let you know. But just think about it. If you haven't put all your plants in yet, maybe you've got some late tomatoes or something, some late peppers, think about it. You say, okay, whatever comes off this plant right here or these two pepper plants right at the end of the row, by gosh, all that's going to the Society of St. Vincent de Paul. It's a nice thought, and they can really use your help. Okay, we'll take a break and be back to talk more with Attorney Will White here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words.
That frightening sound is one we hear quite often throughout the day. Our heart quickens and immediately we wonder what happened. A medical emergency can be frightening. Every tick of the clock crucial. And that's why Butler Ambulance Service is dedicated to be there with every ounce of care possible. Butler Ambulance Service is within minutes of providing you or a loved one with treatment and transportation. Call 282-9595 to find out more. Butler Ambulance Service is a phone call away from serving you.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Welcome back, listeners. It's Ask the Lawyer today. If you're joining us a little bit late, our guest is attorney Will White. He's a senior associate attorney for Dillon, McCandless, King, Coulter, and Graham here in Butler. He's got more than 20 years' experience in municipal law, school law, domestic relations, and he's been focusing a lot in the areas of education and oil and gas law here in Butler, Venango, and Mercer counties. You have been involved in oil and gas law for quite a while, haven't you?
I think I may have told you the first time I was in a few years back, I kind of grew up in it. My mother, you certainly know my mom.
Former senator. Yeah, Mary Jo White.
She came up through Quaker State, and all the time I was in certainly junior high and high school and college, she was with Quaker State. And so all of my summer jobs dating back to my early teens were in one aspect or another working in the oil and gas industry. And obviously, as I got older, I got to do a little bit more daring type work, and it culminated my final year. I was actually down in Lafayette, Louisiana, working on an offshore rig down there, but I also spent a few years up in Emlenton at the refinery. I spent some years up in Pleasantville as a roustabout in the fields. So I've always had an interest in the oil and gas industry. I guess it just comes naturally through the bloodlines, and when I first got out of law school, would do the occasional oil and gas lease, but back then, you know, it might be for the 1,000-acre hunting club or the 500-acre farmer. Anybody who had less than probably 100 acres didn't know what an oil and gas lease was, and there was really no money in it to be made back then.
Yeah, the oil, a lot of folks will remember that, well, Pennsylvania, in fact, and Will alluded to this, Colonel Drake up at Titusville drilled the first well, very shallow, and the oil boom around here, in the communities around here, Grease City, outside of Butler, I understand, once was a humongous community with derricks all over the place. But the oil supply, there was not a whole lot of it, and it was very quickly gone from these shallow wells, and that's one of the reasons why we're talking about the conventional oil industry collapsed around here so quickly. There just wasn't a whole lot of oil in those wells.
I just recently took my children. I was up visiting my parents who were up in the Oil City area now, and I was visiting with them, with my children, my two youngest, and I took them over to see that technically the world's oldest continuously producing oil well is still active up in Rouseville, just outside of Oil City. McClintock, number one. And you can actually, it's just a small little, you know, wooden four-barrel with an old iron jack well there, and you can actually go there and take a little bottle and dip it in and take some oil out of the four-barrel, and we all did that. But yeah, McClintock well is still producing to this day. It may not be producing more than a dribble a day, but it's producing.
Pennsylvania crude. Well, there was a period once that oil boom died out that, as Will said, there wasn't a whole lot of interest in oil and gas law here in Pennsylvania until the development of hydraulic fracking. I understand the technology that was actually around for a while, but it wasn't perfected to the point where it made economic sense for companies to do it. It cost more to get it out of the ground than they could sell it for. Once that was perfected, then there was an explosion in the few areas of the country where there was a lot of gas in the Marcellus Shale area, and one of those areas happens to be western Pennsylvania.
I chuckle because I'm sure the industry would not like you to use the word explosion in that regard.
Oh.
you are absolutely correct. Certainly the Texas and Oklahoma basin is where they, for lack of a better word, experimented and certainly developed the technology. I first really became aware of the technology. If you recall, we had the BP offshore rig a few years back. I'm guessing probably back prior to 2008 or so. But and if you may recall that the way they finally got that under control was they brought in a group who were unconventional drillers, and they brought their equipment in, and they were able to put a second rig away from the first rig and then directionally drill, and they hit that well bore. Now think of the technology and just the amazing ability to be perhaps a mile away drilling through the ocean and hit a 12-inch or 18-inch bore and hit it perfectly to the point where you can now relieve the pressure that was coming up through that well bore so they could in fact cap it and put it out. That's when I realized that, you know, the technology and the intricacy we're dealing with this is just astronomical.
We also can't forget the rights of individual landowners, whether you own a lot of property or even a little. These people certainly have the right to be able to gain as much financially as they can from the gas underneath their property.
Or not if they don't.
Or not if
I think
don't
that's of course, I think sometimes the bigger issue is that some people feel as though they're almost compelled to lease, whether it's through the, I hate to use the high pressure tactic, so to speak, of the landmen, or a very common situation is all of my neighbors have signed, I may as well sign, either because I feel if I don't sign, they're going to take it anyways, which is a common concern. We have the rule of capture in Pennsylvania that technically if the oil and gas can be drawn from off-site, it belongs to the person who's drawing it, even though it might be coming from under my property if they're not under my property. So we have the rule of capture, and that can be used to coerce people into signing when they don't want to sign. And another is just the sway of public opinion that I might be told that if I don't sign, well, all my neighbors who've signed, they're not going to get their leases because even though they've signed, they're not going to produce without my property. So now it's almost that, you know, the pressure of the schoolyard. Everyone has to do it or no one's going to get to pay or get paid, and you're the lone holdout, and I don't want to be the bad guy in my neighborhood type thing.
Let me ask you one more question. I want to talk a little bit about school safety because I know you've been working in that area, and it's been in the news again, unfortunately, recently. We've been talking about Marcellus Shale. There's another layer deeper down, Utica Shale, and apparently gas in there. Do these leases that people have signed around here, are they specifically for the Marcellus layer, or could companies come back later on with additional technology and drill another mile down to the Utica to take more gas?
Well, the easy answer is that from the leases that I've seen, prior to about 2010, we were often able to get the landowners what we would call a lease that had a depth severance. And so oftentimes we'd have in the lease that we were only leasing down to a certain depth, in this case the Marcellus. I think the oil and gas industry obviously became wise to that and realized that the Utica, in fact, is even better than the Marcellus in many respects. So very rarely, and I mean very rarely, I could think of maybe one hand of the hundreds of leases I've done. I could count maybe two or three in the last 5 years where we have those depth severance clauses. So majority of leases now are what we are from the surface to the basement being the core of the earth, and that would include
down as far as you want to go. Huh?
Yeah, so you've got the Marcellus. You've actually got there's a above it to you also what's known as the Rhine Street. The Rhine Street is solid in this area too. So you have the Rhine Street layer, you have the Marcellus layer, and then below that you have the Utica.
It's a layer I hadn't heard of before. Listen, I want to talk a little bit about school law, particularly school safety. As I recall, the Butler Area School District was one of the first in the state, if not in the country, to make a decision to arm its school safety officers. Now, in the Butler Area School District, and this is to the best of my knowledge, I think this is still in effect, all of these security officers are retired police officers, obviously with the training and so on to handle guns. I guess more and more school districts are opting for this, opting to to arm their security offices or no?
Well, let me first take a step back. The Butler School District was one of the first in the Commonwealth. Correct.
Mm-hmm.
By no means were we one of the first in the United States. In fact, if you look back at back in 2012 when we had Sandy Hook, which of course seemed to really kind of springboard this mm-hmm. issue into the public light, and Columbine obviously before that, and then Virginia Tech. But if you look at 2012 as kind of the benchmark, in 2012 there were actually 19 states out of the 50 that allowed guns to be possessed, firearms to be possessed on school campuses, provided that the school had certain parameters, they established the rules, whatever. Pennsylvania is not one of them. In fact, Pennsylvania is just the opposite. We have a law, we have a statutory provision which says firearms may not be possessed on school grounds. So, there are actually 19 states that were doing this long before Butler School District considered doing it. With regard to what we can do in Pennsylvania, you're absolutely correct. The school police that are being created almost always are former PA state troopers. And you use the phrase law enforcement. I'd actually say it's more limiting than that. They're typically, in fact, I think everyone I've encountered is a former PA state trooper. Mm-hmm. And that's because the training they had and have had and have received actually meets the criteria for the bit of the loophole that I have to give, I guess, give him his due. Tom King kind of discovered the loophole, which was that although the law says you can't possess firearms on school grounds, if you've received certain training and you're accredited, you are deemed to be a law enforcement officer. And in this case, when the law enforcement officers are actually hired by the school district, they convert from police to school police, which makes them technically a school employee. So now it's a school employee who possesses a firearm on school grounds, and if that school employee who possesses the firearm has received certain accreditation and certain training, as our PSP have in this Commonwealth, they are permitted to carry on the school grounds. Mm-hmm. So I believe every school police officer, at least that we've ever been involved with in the various districts in Western Pennsylvania, is in fact a former PSP.
As I recall, it was right after the Sandy Hook tragedy that the Butler Area School District decided to do this. In fact, did it in rather short order. I'm trying to recall the details, but they got a special approval from a judge to do it within a matter of days. Is this, in fact, becoming more common in school districts across the Commonwealth?
It's certainly in this area, you're right. I would say that was that happened, I believe, in December of 12, I think, is when I'm thinking Sandy Hook.
I know it was in December. Yeah.
And I would say 13 was kind of when everyone was talking about it. 14 and 15 was everyone was doing it in Butler County. And I would say everyone, obviously, I mean the majority of the districts we were representing. So mm-hmm. in smaller districts, we're considering it districts like Carnes City and Moniteau, and obviously the larger districts like Butler or Seneca Valley, that type of thing. It's still being discussed, and it's also being discussed on a grander scale. There are just about every year there are various bills introduced that would make it permissible across the state for schools to arm its employees or to have its own school police, that type of thing. It's been introduced. They're usually called sentinel laws. It's been introduced in Pennsylvania. It's not gained the traction to get to the floor for any type of vote, but it's usually introduced, the sentinel law, which would make it easier for school districts to arm its personnel. As recently as just last year, I had a district I was working with where they actually seriously considered it. I think a resident brought it to their, and said, hey, why don't we do this? They were trying to decide whether they could legally have a cache of weapons in a centrally located spot on their campus.
An armory or something.
Yeah, basically. Were they permitted? And that was the question I had to research for them and get back to them. Were they permitted to have a cache? Could we just, when I say cache, it might be nothing more than a single firearm. But mm-hmm. the point is, could mm-hmm. they have firearms stored on campus in case of a need? So it's still something that's talked about to this day. I think what I'm seeing, though, is most of the districts that wanted to go that route have already gone that route or have decided they're not going that route. And the ones that did not go with school police, of course, went with alternatives. Alternatives being safer barriers, safer doors, mm-hmm. Certainly metal detectors was a common thing that many schools considered.
And any visitor has to ring in to the office before they even get in right. from the outside.
You have the trap door typically mm-hmm. system now where you have to go through a double door. First door gets you into a kind of a vestibule area, and then mm-hmm. that's when they identify you and you can't get through the second door, and they can use that both ways. It can also be used to trap somebody trying to get out. I've seen most of the districts that wanted to go that route have gone that route. I don't encounter too many more districts right now that are thinking about school police. Now, there is a secondary issue. It's what's known as a school resource officer, and a lot of districts do that, and we encounter that pretty regularly. A school resource officer typically is not a school employee. It's usually, in fact, a local law enforcement officer, and it's oftentimes the districts that either couldn't afford to create their own police force or there just wasn't sufficient public opinion for it. Instead, what they often do is they contract out with the local police departments, and they get, sometimes it's referred to as a DARE officer, mm-hmm. they get an officer mm-hmm. in the school who is still an employee of the police department, but they may designate an area where that officer would have an office in the school and has free rein to work within the school.
We may have time to squeeze in one more comment here from a listener. Caller, go right ahead. It's your turn.
Hey, Dave, I just called to tell you that we really enjoyed that gentleman today. Will, that's very educated, and it's nice you got somebody on who knows what you're talking about.
we appreciate the unsolicited testimonial, and I'm sure Attorney Will White does as well. Now, seriously, I appreciate your comments on that. I really
do. My brother.
I learned a lot in an hour.
Okay, so did I. Thanks, my friend. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hey, that's what we like to do here. That was our purpose when we started the Ask the Lawyer program. It's educational. It's informational. That's what we tried to do here, and we wouldn't be able to do it without the cooperation of our local attorneys and certainly the Butler County Bar Association and Executive Director Janice Hackett. And a special thanks to our attorney who visited with us today, Will White, Senior Associate Attorney at Dillon, McCandless, King, Coulter, and Graham here in Butler. Nice to see you again. Nice to have you back.
Happy to be here. I hope it won't be 2-3 years for my next visit, although I know there's a long line of attorneys who like to do this.
Yes, and, we've had, actually, I've done a couple of programs with patent attorneys. Now, you talk about learning information. You know, I didn't know anything about that. That's more of a need around here than you would imagine.
I know absolutely. Yeah. What I know about patent law is basically when the issue comes across my desk, I know which phone to pick up and which guy to call in Pittsburgh.
Well, that's the other thing we've learned, and our listeners have learned, that different attorneys focus in different areas, and they're the first to say, you know, if you go to an attorney, well, that's not really an area where I have a lot of expertise. I would recommend so-and-so or so-and-so or so-and-so.
Just like society's changed, the practice has changed. That's absolutely correct. When mm-hmm. I was growing up in a family of lawyers, it was very common to have the sole practitioner who hung out his or her shingle and basically did whatever came in the door and paid the bills, and one day you were doing criminal, the next day you were doing civil, the next day you were doing bankruptcy. That's a lost art. That's both good and bad, but it is it's true that these days I think the majority of the practitioners focus on one or two areas and seem to be I'll concentrate on this and let the others take care of the others that I don't know about.
Attorney Will White visiting with us today. Thanks again, Will.
Thank you, Dave.
More to come on It's Your Turn. Please stick around. We're going to be talking with the sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Wall Street Journal. His name is Jason Gay. He's a funny guy, but he also has a lot to say about little victories in life. Intrigued? Stick around. We'll be talking with him by telephone on the next segment of It's Your Turn in just a couple of minutes. We'll be right back.
In today's world, getting an education is more important than ever. Whether you're just finishing high school, starting a new career, or looking to upgrade your skills and knowledge, Butler County Community College is the smart place to start. At BC3, we're all about giving you easy access to classes close to home with 6 Western PA locations, online or hybrid courses, certificate programs, 54 2-year career and transfer programs, and BC3 now has bachelor's degree opportunities. We'll help you every step along the way with registration, financial aid, and so much more. You can get information online at bc3.edu. Or you can call the admissions office at 724-284-8501. You need to find out for yourself why BC3 was recently named the number one community college in Pennsylvania by schools.com.
Central Electric Cooperative does everything it can to keep costs down for members. If we can reduce electricity purchased during high demand periods, we will help stabilize future power costs for our members. You can help. When you hear a peak alert announcement on the radio, please turn off all non-essential electric items, especially dehumidifiers and pool pumps, and set your air conditioner at a minimum of 78 degrees. Our peaks and the radio broadcast usually occur in the summer months from June to September, and typically in the afternoon between noon and 6 p.m. Alerts usually last between 4 to 6 hours, so be alert for peak alerts. With your help, we can help keep your energy bill down. This is Chris O'Donnell with Central Electric Cooperative, energizing our communities with a cooperative difference.
A little bit of fun time here, listeners, but also some good advice. I think you'll enjoy our conversation upcoming. I know I plan to, with the writer Jason Gay, who's our next guest here on It's Your Turn on WISR. And if you're joining us a little bit late this afternoon, that's fine. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest joins us by telephone. Jason Gay, nice to meet you. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Dave. And I am speaking by a telephone. You know, people actually use these things in their pockets still as phones. It's amazing.
Listeners, you will pick up straight away, I'm sure, the fact that Jason Gay has an extremely droll sense of humor. And believe me, you'll see it in his book. That's what we're going to talk about today, New York Times bestseller. The title is Little Victories, A Sports Writer's Notes on Winning at Life. And indeed, Jason Gay is a sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal, although he's also written for a number of other publications, which you will have heard of, Rolling Stone, GQ, and some others. But he's a sports columnist, regular sports columnist at the Wall Street Journal. When did you get the idea for this series of essays, Little Victories, Jason?
Well, I was always the person who was an easy target for an advice book. I don't know if you're an advice book reader, but I certainly have been. And, you know, I'd walk through the airport and see those books promising me a 4-hour work week or washboard abs or the cleanest home you could possibly have organized. And I always read these books, enjoyed them, but just didn't find them relatable. So I wanted to write an advice book for imperfect people, a rule book for people who had a hard time following rules. And that's what Little Victories is at its heart. It's practical advice for people who have a hard time following practical advice. And I put myself squarely in that category.
This book is uproariously funny at times, but also very poignant at times, very moving at times, depending on the subject that you're undertaking. And you cover a wide range of topics.
Well, I appreciate that. You know, it's certainly my intention going into it to write almost strictly a humor book. But the sort of core message of Little Victories is to sort of take satisfaction in those small, you know, ordinary, somewhat mundane life events that we sometimes take for granted, and, you know, not just worry about the giant sweeping accomplishments and so on. And the thing that happened in the course of writing this book was my father became very sick, and for him, his life really did become about little victories. It was about making sure that he got a little time every day to talk to his grandchildren or go for a walk or even just get in the car and go for a drive. You know, things that we took for granted in the many, many times we had done previously, but suddenly took on all this new meaning and weight. So, yeah, I mean, a book that, again, began as really a humor book for me, you know, had a bigger weight at the end of it because of everything that was going on.
Well, I can understand how you would get the idea to write a humor book to mock advice books, because they're all over the place and most of them are totally unrealistic. And they're mostly pie in the sky and all of it, abstract, gobbledygook, instead of real nuts and bolts advice. And I love your approach. It's not always the big game. It's not always the grand gesture, but it's the little victories. It's the little things in life that really sometimes bring us the most happiness.
Sometimes it's just getting those pants on before 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Saturday. You know what I mean? You know, sometimes you just have one of those days where you can barely crawl out of bed, the kids are driving you crazy, or you've got a whole bunch of chores and errands to run, and if you can just get those pants on before two, that's a little victory.
This is a good book, folks, if you're an individual who doesn't have a whole lot of time to read at once. You can easily pick up little victories and, you know, just zip through one of the many essays. There are close to 20 of them in the book, and then mull that over until the next time you get a chance to pick up the book. Let's talk about
I'm grateful for you to say that. That's the kind of book that I like to read, frankly. You know, I have a busy life. Again, I have a young family, and I read books. I love books that I can open up at any page and get a laugh, get a smile. Books that I can read backward to frontward, pick it up in the middle. And that's exactly the kind of book I tried to write. So if it is a book that you get, thank you. And if you enjoy it, you can enjoy it in any manner, in any room, in any activity you want. I that's what I made it for.
Well, I'm very sincere about that. I'm a reader. I read a lot, but it's frustrating sometimes life intervenes when you're reading a good book. You put
sure.
it down, you get two or three going at the same time, you pick one up again, you say, let's see, where was I the last time I was reading this book?
Exactly. I promise it's slightly less complicated than The Hobbit or Game of Thrones.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that you write about, and I'll just let you discuss them a little bit, obviously,
sure.
a lot more detail in your book. You talk about how to build the perfect wedding playlist without being a snob.
Yeah. Well, you know, this was a chapter that, you know, when this book came out in hardcover, I had no idea what the reaction would be. And for whatever reason, people have responded to this. And I think because weddings are just such a universal experience, and all of us have, you know, if we haven't been married ourselves, we've probably been to quite a few weddings, and we've all been to a wedding where people danced the night completely away and it was rocking. And then we've also been to that slightly awkward wedding where people barely danced at all. And oftentimes that comes down to the music and what the band plays or what the DJ plays. And my core advice when you're planning music for a wedding is to play the hits. Play the songs that people love, that people know, that your dad knows, that mom knows, that everybody can sing the lyrics to. It is not the night to break out the obscurities, the sort of, you know, the strange music that you might have appreciated when you were a college student. You're not trying to show off that night. If you want to get people moving on the dance floor, play The Temptations, play Stevie Wonder, play Michael Jackson, play the songs that people want to dance to. It's really straightforward advice, but I think it works every time.
You also say be careful about soliciting requests from your guests. Nothing like Cousin Stu dragging the whole wedding to a halt with requesting a horse with no name.
That's true. And that comes from a little bit of experience. When my wife and I were married, my wife sent around an email to all our wedding guests asking for them to each make a request of a song they'd like to hear in the playlist. And while that was an incredibly magnanimous gesture on my wife, by my wife, that creates quite an erratic playlist. So we eventually had to overrule that approach, because you have to have some curation there. You have to have a DJ or somebody who kind of knows, okay, this song comes after this song, and you don't want to play that song after this song. You need someone, some oversight from one smart person.
I love your remark. By the end of the night, the dance floor is just your drunkest friend dancing by himself or herself to "I Will Survive."
Yeah. And I think also about "I Will Survive," that song is, I don't think of it as a song that people dance with each other to. I think of it as a song that is just a bunch of individual solo interpretive dances, because, it is a, it's not a traditional waltz. It's not, you know, a disco type, you know, a partner song. Yeah, it's more your own interpretation of "I Will Survive."
We have a few more minutes, listeners, that we're able to chat with Jason Gay. We need to take a break, though, so let's do that. We'll pick up our conversation with him here on It's Your Turn on WISR right after these words. One of our sponsors on the program this Thursday, Miller's Quality Meats, downtown Butler, right in the heart of downtown at 142 North Main Street. Miller's Quality Meats, right next to Cummings Candy and a Coffee Shop. They have weekly specials there. By the way, you can sign up, like I did, for their free weekly email service every Wednesday morning. Automatically appears in your email the specials that are good for the next week. For example, yesterday morning in the email, there it was. Specials for the following week. If you're a pork lover, boneless butterfly to pork loin chops, $2.59 a pound. Love pork chops, huh? Also, if you're a poultry lover, they've got chicken drumsticks for 59 cents a pound right now. They've got marinated chicken breast. That's another thing you'll find at Miller's Quality Meats, a variety of already marinated meat products. For example, this week, marinated chicken breast. You could choose Dixie Herb, Sweet Bourbon, or Mojito Lime. Marinated chicken breast, $2.59 a pound. Yeah, $2.59 a pound. Also, party trays and sandwich trays available at Miller's Meats. Whether you're, you know, putting something together for the big game that everybody's going to watch, or for the backyard picnic or barbecue, sandwich trays, chunk meat and cheese trays, smoked meat and cheese trays, variety of sizes. Talk to the folks at Miller's Quality Meats. They'll let you know what they have. By the way, there's always a good recipe or two as well in the weekly email. Oh, and it's graduation time, isn't it? Yes, graduation season, graduation parties. They've got wonderful graduation party trays available, too. It's a spotlight item right now. Miller's Quality Meats, 142 North Main Street in downtown Butler. A wonderful, wonderful place. They smoke their own meats there. They do spiral-sliced ham right there. They have two facilities for smoking right there in the building, right there. Miller's Quality Meats. You'll never get it any fresher. 142 North Main Street, downtown Butler.
Today we're speaking with fellowship-trained orthopedic spine surgeon Dr. Scott Rainey from Tri-Rivers Surgical Associates. Dr. Rainey, can you explain the types of conditions you treat and what training you have in these areas?
At Tri-Rivers, I treat various types of spinal conditions, including spinal stenosis, degenerative disc disease, disc herniation, and compression fractures. I completed my spine training at Texas Back Institute, where I focused on the treatment of degenerative spinal conditions in the cervical and lumbar areas.
What methods do you use to treat patients with these conditions?
More than 90% of patients with back pain respond to conservative treatments such as rest, medication, strengthening exercises, or injections. If the patient's still in pain after that period of conservative care, the possibility of spine surgery will then be discussed with the patient.
To learn more, call Tri-Rivers Surgical Associates at their Butler location in the Clearview Mall, toll-free 866-874-7483. On the web at intro@tririversortho.com.
Welcome back. If you're joining us a little bit late on It's Your Turn this afternoon here on WISR, that's fine. Welcome. My name is Dave Malarkey. Our guest is Jason Gay. Jason is a sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. For the purposes of our conversation today, we're discussing his New York Times bestseller, Little Victories. That's the title, Little Victories, a sports writer's notes on winning at life. And the review copy that I have in my hand here, Jason, is a paperback, so I assume this is the release of the paperback edition of the original hardback. Am I right on that?
Yes, it is, and I hope there's that $100 bill that I left on page 40 for you in there, Dave.
where do I look? you also talk about, and I'm just picking and choosing here, you talk about how to support your kids' sports without coming to blows with another sport parent somewhere in the parking lot or in the grandstand.
Oh, man. I mean, this is a topic dear to my heart because I grew up the son of a high school coach, and I have young children of my own who are, you know, starting to get underway with kiddie sports. And it seems that if you're following the news, there's not a week that goes by without a report about two parents tangling outside a little league field or a hockey rink or a football field. And it just goes to show that the fear nowadays isn't about the kids in the sports, it's the parents. And we really have a culture that's gone amok in terms of the way that we have over-prioritized youth sports. And part of the reason I feel strongly about, you know, taking this intensity down a notch is that you know, my job allows me to be around professional athletes. And in talking with them over the years, one of the things you find, interestingly enough, is that a great many professional athletes, people who are at the tops of their sports, oftentimes didn't really specialize in a sport their entire lives. They maybe came to it late, maybe didn't even try out for the varsity until they were a junior or senior or high school, maybe even picked it up after that. And they really believe that they didn't burn out and that they became the successful athletes they became because they didn't over-focus and over-specialize on something. So I think that's something to keep in mind as parents sort of start to navigate youth sports, that, you know, going all in and going too crazy in terms of focusing on one thing, turning one activity into a 12-month affair, might backfire for a whole number of reasons.
You offer your advice on friendships, hoard your friends, but beware of birthday party creep. What's that
about? You know, I love this chapter, but I do sound a little grumpy in that. Okay, first of all, hoarding your friends. I can be a very good friend, and I can also be a friend who falls out of touch rather easily. This is something that I talk about in the book, about the importance of maintaining those relationships into adulthood and nurturing them in the same way we did when we were younger, because those friends are critical to your personal happiness. They're critical to your journey in life, and I think we all need to, you know, maintain those relationships as we go on and do a better job of maintaining relationships. But in terms of the birthday party thing, look, this is partly a reaction, frankly, to my wife is the greatest friend who has ever existed. I mean, she is the person who will go to every birthday party. She will get you a present. She will make sure she knows the names of all your kids, your coworkers, your boss, the ex-husband, everybody. She's on it. However, you end up going to a lot of birthday parties because of this. And when you end up going to about 12, 35th birthday parties, it starts to wear you out. And maybe this is just makes me sound like a cranky guy, but I believe in the sort of the temple of birthdays, okay? We're going to do 16. We'll do 21. We'll do 40. You want to do 40? Fine. We'll do 40. We'll do 50. We'll do 75. We don't have to do 73. 75 is good. And, of course, we'll go completely all out for 100 if you make it there. But I don't think it's necessary to go completely hog wild for 30-second birthdays.
We're talking to Jason Gay. Let me ask you about one more thing. Our time begins to run short here. You talk about going home for the holidays without abandoning your family at a highway rest stop. What's that all about, Jason?
Well, you know, I don't think there is a experience more emotionally fraught than the family holiday experience. I don't care if you celebrate Thanksgiving or Christmas or some other holiday. Anytime you are gathering with family, and especially extended family, in a confined setting that sometimes and probably includes alcohol, there's bound to be some moments that are trying. And the thing that I urge is patience. You know, patience and listening to mom. I mean, mom is really the driver of most of these events, if we're honest, right? And we got to make sure mom is happy. And mom is going to be happy if you stay at the house with the kids. She doesn't want you staying down the road at the hotel. She wants you staying at the house. She wants you helping out. She doesn't want you ordering food. She wants you being part of that whole experience and, you know, just integrating your entire family into it. We have to grin. We have to survive it. But also try to appreciate it more, because these people have been part of your life forever. And, you know, I think all of us learn along the way, you know, as I certainly have, that, you know, those relationships that we think are permanent aren't, and they are finite, and we have to make sure to appreciate people when they're with us.
Absolutely true. Here in our area, western Pennsylvania, we're just outside of Pittsburgh, Jason,
sure.
There's a lot of people who stay here. A lot, I mean, obviously, you know, people who move away to other parts of the country, but there's many, many people who have been in western Pennsylvania all their lives, and, you know, they have families here. One of my favorite columnists, his name is Brian O'Neill. He writes for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
Sure, I know he is, yeah.
He's been a guest on the program with us a couple of times. Funny guy, by the way.
Yeah.
But he just today, in fact, wrote about watching how many families here in western Pennsylvania watch Steeler games on TV at grandma's house. just like their father did and just like their father before that did. It's just it's a ritual on Sunday afternoons to go to Grandma's and, you know, watch the Steeler game. And he, I mean, obviously there's a little humor there, but it's very poignant.
I love that. And it's part of what I love about the job that I have in writing about sports. I mean, you know, all of us, there are a million places where you can read about, you know, this player doing that and this team doing the other thing. But what I love about sports most of all are the traditions, are those kinds of moments like what you described going to Grandma's. Now, do we complain about Grandma's TV if she has this old, you know, RCA black and white with the knobs on it, or do we have to get Grandma a flat screen?
You just have to enjoy the moment and enjoy the food and, and realize that this won't be forever.
Yeah. Oh, I love it.
You had one thing, I must mention this because it's one of my pet peeves too. You're talking about how to, and Jason talks about this, he writes about this in his book, folks, Little Victories. You have to know how to distinguish really, really stressful situations. Okay, what's really important? Okay, you know, you get fired at your workplace or you're attacked by a bear or something like that. That's serious. But there are non-stress inconveniences that we all have. Don't worry so much about them. Netflix is buffering, or, this is my favorite, anything to do with fantasy sports. That drives me nuts. ESPN has whole afternoons that they dedicate to this during the football season. I don't know how anybody can watch that.
Oh, boy. And listen, you know, bless them, but we've all been in conversations with coworkers sitting by the coffee machine where they talk about their fantasy football weekend, and boy, short of hearing someone talk about painting their barn, I can't imagine a conversation more dull than that. Fantasy football is, you know, one of the things that I understand why it's appealing and it's addictive and stuff, but it's more interesting to you than anybody else. I can assure you of that.
Who will appreciate your book most? Jason Gay, young people, older people, who will laugh their head off, but yet still say, that's pretty good stuff there. Who will say that?
Well, not to sound like a used car salesman, but I really wrote this book for everybody out there. I think that, you know, folks, your parents, your dads, your grads, grandma will get a kick out of it, young and old. And it's really spoken to as broad an audience as possible because, frankly, that's been the audience I've been writing to for the Journal for a long time. People who might like sports, people who don't care about sports at all, read this paper, and I'm trying to reach and connect with as many people as possible.
And if you want to read about the diaper bag that promises to make you look like Steve McQueen, that's in here too. The New York Times bestseller now in paperback, Little Victories by Jason Gay. Little Victories, a sports writer's notes on winning at life. And if you're looking for Jason online, it's Gay, G-A-Y, Jason Gay, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal and author of Little Victories. Jason, enjoyed the conversation. Thanks for being with us today.
I'm very grateful. Thank you, Dave. Bye-bye.
Sure. Bye-bye.
Midday lottery numbers for today. The pick two is 15-15. The pick 3, 185-185. The pick 4, 8825. The pick 5, 01222. And your treasure hunt, 6, 8, 16, 17, and 22. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $10,000. Lottery numbers brought to you by New Haven Court at Clearview.
At New Haven Court at Clearview, you don't have to pay a king's ransom to experience the royal touch. With their trial stay program, you can enjoy a respite getaway and experience the assisted living community that brings together a wealth of personalized services, activities, and amenities to create a cozy, home-like, family-friendly atmosphere. Enjoy fine dining, a cozy afternoon in the sunroom, the security of care supervised by an RN, and much, much more. Call 724-477-8701 today.
Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The
bus. We're going your way. Getting there stops here. Just hop the bus. Easy and economical. Just hop the bus. No car, no problem. The bus will get you there. 'Cause that's what we do. Hop the bus. Leave the driving up to us.
The bus.
We're going your way.
good program today. Thanks for being with us. A special thanks to local attorney Will White, senior associate attorney at Dillon McCandless King Coulter and Graham here in Butler. Interesting discussion, very interesting and informative discussion today, particularly on oil and gas law and also on school and school safety law. Attorney H. William White, Will White. Also, fun to talk with Jason Gay, too, sports columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Coming up on tomorrow's program, open talk to kick off the Friday edition of It's Your Turn. We can talk about latest developments in the presidential race. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton going at it hammer and tong. And also the tragedy of the gorilla and a little kid in the Cincinnati Zoo. Anything you want to talk about. And we'll have a guest giving us all the highlights of the Three Rivers Arts Festival, which gets underway in Pittsburgh tomorrow. I think it's first day, right? Yeah. We'll talk about it tomorrow. Meanwhile, enjoy the rest of your Thursday. We'll see you tomorrow on It's Your Turn here on WISR 680 Butler.